You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. After the Islamic State, or ISIS, attacked French civilians in Paris, the hacktivist group Anonymous decided to turn its cyber weapons against the extremist group. Previous targets have included the Church of Scientology and the consultant group Stratfor. What is the driving political ethos of Anonymous? With us is Luke Good. He's a senior lecturer in media, film, and television at the University of Auckland and the author of the book Jürgen Habermas, Democracy in the Public Sphere. He has also published widely on social media, citizen journalism, and hacktivism. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Luke Good. It's great to have you here with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You've been studying these hacktivist groups as well as slacktivist groups and fitting them within some sort of political understanding about what they really are. I thought maybe we should start with how many groups roughly are there that are significant and how did they emerge? What are these hacktivists?
Well, there are a range of different groups, and even a group like Anonymous is a sort of umbrella term for various subgroups that sometimes split away from Anonymous. That particular grouping that's become so prominent in recent years really emerged out of a kind of subculture of kind of hacking and pranksterism, and really this sort of politicized activism part of it really grew after that. That wasn't really the sort of necessarily the driver that got this whole thing started. There have been other groups in the past, like people hacking in support of Zapatistas, for example, and that's one of the sort of famous examples from the past, in which the political project is what gets this thing going. Anonymous is rather different. You know, it comes out of online subculture and a growing anger towards attempts to regulate the net, attempts to censor, attempts by groups to shut down arguments and opinions that are antagonistic toward them. So it's a kind of really interesting and very diverse and at times seemingly kind of amorphous kind of collective, if you like.
You had named a few others in this paper that you published about Anonymous. I think one was Cult of the Dead Cow, one was called Electronic Disturbance Theater. How do these all fit together? Are there people who cross over?
It's difficult to know how much crossover there is. These groups have sort of emerged and become prominent at different periods in the internet's relatively short history. But I think what sort of connects them is this merging of political activism, hacking, and a kind of performance as well. There's a kind of dramatic performance that goes along with these activities, which makes them highly visible and for many people kind of entertaining to watch, as well as sort of hard to pin down and hard to characterize.
Now, it's because they are anonymous, how can we, as scholars or even journalists, have a sense of how many people are involved? How do they become anonymous? Can they get thrown out of Anonymous without identities, without any kind of structure? How do you know?
Yeah, sure. This stuff is hard to track. And my own work, actually, I have to say, is not really designed to get sort of inside that organization. So, for example, the most prominent anthropologist, if you like, of Anonymous would be Gabriella Coleman, who's actually done a lot of work actually with members of Anonymous. And there have been journalistic accounts that have got quite close to some of the key figures within Anonymous. There was a documentary by Brian Knappenberger a few years ago, which cast Anonymous in what for many people would be a kind of new sort of light and showed real faces to these people. And
not
so,
the Guy Fawkes face?
Well, it actually sort of looked behind the Guy Fawkes face for some members. It was only a small snapshot, but it gave you an interesting insight into the kinds of backgrounds that some of the members come from, the certain kind of demographic profile, although we need to be careful not to stereotype, because actually there are people from different walks of life increasingly joining in these activities. It's easy to stereotype Anonymous as basically young male geeks, because that might be the dominant demographic kind of sort of makeup, but it is actually more diverse than that. And the whole idea of Anonymous is precisely that, and it's a problematic idea in many ways, the idea that sort of identity, one's identity and one's background are somehow irrelevant and can be set aside, and that it's what goes on online that is important. And so that's in many ways sort of premised on, the idea, and it, in some ways it seems like a sort of slightly old-fashioned idea now that was very prominent with the emergence and popularization of the internet and in its sort of early days, was this idea of a kind of clear split between one's online and one's offline existence and identity.
One of the things you were trying to assess is what is the political ethos of Anonymous? Sure. And it really seems to have a split personality in many ways, kind of fitting in with populism on one side. You talked about a nihilism versus idealism, for example, and how maybe both are present. How does this manifest itself?
I think before we get into some of those sort of tensions or contradictions even within a group like Anonymous, we should perhaps put it in a bit of context and sort of recognize that political movements are very often draw on contradictory or have sort of ideological or ethical kind of tensions within them. So that's sort of not unique. But I think I was struck when trying to, by looking at the ethos of Anonymous, I think I'm interested in the discourse that they use, the words that they use to express their beliefs. I'm interested in the way that this evokes some of their sort of passions and emotions, the sort of anger and also sort of hope for the future. And I think I was struck by these kind of quite stark, almost binaries, that, you know, the sort of very nihilistic kind of discourse on the one hand, this very, very sort of utopian and idealistic view of a world that could potentially be made so much better if technology were allowed to take its natural course and were not interfered with by big vested interests and particularly sort of governmental interests. So it is a really interesting set of contradictions. One of the reasons that I talk about it within the framework of a kind of populism is, and if you think about the way in which populism has traditionally been studied as movements that can in many ways draw on a sort of a big idea, often quite an abstract idea. Ernesto Laclau, the political theorist, calls it a floating signifier, you know, this idea of the people or democracy or freedom that can sort of house within it some quite different and potentially contradictory interests if you look at them too closely. So Anonymous certainly contains expressions of quite sort of left-wing ideology on the one hand and quite sort of right-wing market anarchism on the other hand. It's a really interesting kind of, and I think quite sort of potent mix of very different ideals.
And can you see this in what they do? Can you see the reflections of these contradictory ideas in the actions that they take?
Well, I think the fact that they are outright opposed to any kind of governmental kind of role within the internet lends itself much more to that sort of libertarian worldview. And on the other hand, many of their sort of operations, particularly in more recent years, think about the way that street protests and so on have been very much framed as part of wider social justice struggles. And so yeah, I think we can see these kind of ideas, which are in standard ideological terms, maybe at odds with one another. And this is one of the things I'm trying to grapple with myself looking at these groups, is whether or not these are ideological tensions that really just kind of are bound at some point to pull the thing apart, or whether or not they genuinely, as I think many of the members of these groups see it, sort of transcending old divisions of left and right, or whether it's, on the other hand, this sort of uneasy amalgam of quite sort of left-right
ideologies. So there's like the idea of social justice on one hand, and yet you point out, for example, in your article, that there's quite a bit of rhetoric that could be construed as sexist, as racist, as homophobic.
Yes. I mean, the way in which freedom of speech is kind of sanctified by the movement, almost above all else, is really interesting. And I think, you know, the point about the use of, at times, sort of misogynistic or homophobic discourse, we see this less in recent years, I have to say. It's more from its sort of subcultural roots growing out of, as I discussed briefly in the article, this sort of 4chan forum online. One of the things I think we should be aware of when we're looking at the way in which Anonymous sanctifies free speech, and that sometimes seems to be in support of any kind of free speech, however offensive. So, for example, the anti-censorship, the anti-pornography filter operations that they've had. We should be careful not necessarily to assume that that maps neatly onto a kind of misogynistic worldviews, for example. I think, you know, this group is particularly interested in sort of pushing the boundaries, testing the boundaries of freedom of speech. And that's why in some of its sort of discourse, it deliberately invokes, you know, a kind of discourse which is self-consciously uncivil and politically incorrect at times, and that's perceived as part of that struggle.
And so what accounts for the organizations they decide to target? They targeted Scientology, they targeted Stratfor, the Westboro Baptist Church, a computer security firm, The Sun at a certain point.
Yep.
And now ISIS, right? So have you been able to make any sense out of the ethos and the targets, or does it not really fit well together?
It's partly that certainly in the past, any institution that is seen in any way to be trying to challenge freedom of speech or trying to shut down controversial opinions, for example, has been sort of fair game. But I also think that Anonymous is, as in terms of its ethos, is characterized by, you know, what we might see as a kind of quite binary view of the world, a quite sort of Manichaean idea of good versus evil. And once a group is identified as being on the side of evil, of which ISIS is a, you know, such an obvious kind of, you know, sort of moment in Anonymous history where they say, right, we've got to go after these guys. They're bad guys, and very obviously so. And so that sort of worldview does get manifested in its kind of actions and in its choice of target.
Plus, of course, ISIS, its attacks on Paris, and then they can connect into that the Charlie Hebdo kind of attack, which would be an attack on free speech, right?
Yes.
So that would fit in with its protection of speech.
Correct. And while many on the sort of progressive side of politics would say that the Charlie Hebdo case, appalling as it was, that there's some contextualization to be had in terms of the position of relative power that Charlie Hebdo had in terms of, you know, were they punching down, for example, in sort of targeting a particular religion. This idea that there's a sort of wider context to debates about free speech. For Anonymous, I think it's not that they are not capable of recognizing that wider context, but I think strategically they say, no, we must draw a line, and it's anything that is on the side of compromising freedom of speech must be targeted head on.
So it would be a group that might even protect hate speech.
Correct, yes. Anonymous has been very careful to distinguish, for example, this isn't hate speech, but been very careful, for example, in its advocacy of total opposition to government-initiated anti-pornography filters on the internet. It's been very careful in recent times to make it clear that child pornography is a different issue. So there are lines clearly to be drawn. But once they are drawn, I think it's fair to say that these issues are seen in quite a binary way by the group. And again, we should recognize that's in the context of activism. That has to be put in the context of a sort of tactical outlook. It's not necessarily that the members themselves aren't capable of discussing and reflecting on, and in fact they frequently do, the kind of nuances of particular issues within the movement itself.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the political ethos of hacktivist group Anonymous. Do you have a sense of how big the movement is?
In terms of numbers, no, I confess I don't, and I haven't really tried to get it.
It seems like it would be very hard.
It seems to almost be a futile kind of
exercise. Because it probably changes from moment to moment, I would think.
Absolutely, and that's one of the points about Anonymous, is that it doesn't have a membership committees, doesn't require people to undergo certain kind of periods of training or
so if you or I decided we wanted to hack into the University of Auckland's website because it was limiting somebody's free speech or whatever that happened to be, would we be able to claim we were part of Anonymous?
If you just go unilaterally and do it under the banner of Anonymous without having consulted, without having brought other people with you, you are liable to bring down a storm of hate upon yourself. Now, the way in which operations emerge is not in a highly structured or hierarchical way. And we see, as is actually happening as we speak with the Op ISIS, the Anonymous kind of operation to target ISIS, you do get loose cannon people doing things which somehow undermine the operation itself. And so there is this kind of trade-off. On the one hand, it's quite amorphous and quite a sort of emergent phenomenon rather than one which is premised on kind of discipline and hierarchy. But at the same time, if you simply, as an individual, were to claim the Anonymous moniker for an operation that was not bringing other people along with it, you would find yourself out in the cold very quickly.
So that's also that tension you talked about in the article between the collectivism and individualism.
Absolutely. There's a strong individualist ethos in ideological terms, the sanctity of the individual and the individual's right to freedom of speech and privacy. And yet there's very much a sort of collective mindset, very much a sort of sense of, you know, the hive mind, the collective wisdom of the crowd. Those sorts of ideas are very fundamental to this movement as well. So it's an interesting tension, and it's not necessarily an outright contradiction, but it challenges, I think, some of our traditional ways of trying to divide up different kind of worldviews.
Yeah, it's interesting in your other piece about populism as well. You talked about the populist heroes like Julian Assange now in this area and Snowden, for example, and how when you look a little bit closer at them, while they've been upheld as, say, left-wing heroes, there's really this very sort of right-wing aspect to them.
And again, these are sort of contradictory figures and hard to pin down in traditional ideological left-right terms. But I give the example of Assange and his sort of particular credo of market anarchism that he subscribes to. And yet, not so much at the moment, but in the past, certainly he has been co-opted as a sort of folk hero of the left and sort of celebrated by figures like John Pilger and Ken Loach, for example. Yet, if you were to look at the ways in which Assange sort of sees the world, sees the future, understands how the internet should, for example, basically render international financial controls redundant. You know, that in many ways is that whole idea is kind of a nightmare. It's sort of anathema to many people on the left who think that the problem is that we've got too little financial
regulation
rather than too much.
Yeah, and similarly, you mentioned Snowden, and yet here's this guy who really loves his guns, and it is again a contradiction. And it's an interesting exercise for people who study framing, where you focus on some things, but you conveniently omit other things.
Yeah. And I have to say that's sort of drawing on information that's come out about Snowden based on sort of history. I should be careful not to claim that I actually really know where Edward Snowden lies currently on the sort of ideological spectrum. But yeah, he has been sort of brought forward by figures like Glenn Greenwald and the Guardian newspaper as a figure that the sort of liberal, progressive left can sort of co-opt for themselves. And yeah, if we look at some of the sentiments that these figures have expressed in the past, we would have to say, well, there's some really uneasy tensions there.
So in terms of the latest activities, we started to talk about the Anonymous decision to go after ISIS. Because of these tensions, before we started taping, you talked about how some of the mistakes that have been made, targeting too broadly, for example. How do you see that all fitting together?
Again, this is partly the trade-off of a movement that is decentralized, that is premised on the idea that its activities grow quite organically and that organization happens sort of laterally. That's too simplistic, that there are hierarchies and people within the movement do sort of adopt and attain kind of positions of relatively, you know, relative power or status. But the idea is that there is this much greater fluidity to this movement. And of course, what that risks is, again, the sort of loose cannons. It risks, as is currently becoming evident in the criticism of Anonymous for the way it's targeting ISIS, that there are people casting the net far too widely. People are naive about who is actually part of IS and who, on the other hand, might just be promoting a particular viewpoint that they might find controversial or problematic. So it's, in many ways, it's a trade-off. It's not to suggest that this is, you know, not the way to run activism, but rather that it carries a lot of risks with it.
And then in terms of other hacktivist groups, how would you compare Anonymous to others? Do you have a sense of what the other hacktivist groups, are they similar, are they different?
I have to say that I haven't really put those under that kind of scrutiny. Obviously, I'm interested primarily in the way that politics and culture intersect, and trying to understand Anonymous as a kind of, what drew me to Anonymous in the first case was as a sort of emerging sort of subcultural movement. And then that got me looking much more at its sort of political outlook and its political operations.
I've been thinking in terms of, so they've come up with the term hacktivist, so people who are activists via hacking. Then we've got the clicktivists, people who, that's all they do. And then, of course, there are the slacktivists. So how do you see all this in terms of the emergent political terrain?
I think the term slacktivist, and to a lesser extent clicktivist, has really sort of taken on a kind of almost a sort of moralizing kind of hue to it, that actually, and we're moving away here from hacking activities. We're moving here towards talking about people who use the internet to undertake some kind of action, whether it's pledging a small amount of money to a particular organization, crowdfunding a particular project, or simply expressing approval.
Signing a petition,
likes and so on.
So would you see this on a spectrum?
Yes, absolutely. But I think I would be very wary, though, of putting slacktivism at one end and so-called real activism at the other end. I think it's much more complex than that. And I'm very wary of people who use the term slacktivist too easily, too dismissively, to really argue that unless you're doing things in a kind of quite traditional way, unless you're out on the streets, that somehow you're not affecting any kind of meaningful change. But I think the term slacktivism has helped to sort of bring forward some interesting debates about what the internet really does offer for activists and many of its sort of inherent limitations as well as its strengths, and certainly the relatively unbounded optimism that was kind of about the internet and its potential to energize people as activists and to become more active citizens and so on. A lot of that sort of unbounded optimism has sort of waned in recent years as people have become a little bit more world weary and a little bit more skeptical about what you can achieve by doing stuff online. Obviously, the Kony campaign was and is still singled out as the obvious sort of example. And in many ways, it's a slightly unfair example because it's the one spectacular failure, if you like, that people sort of draw on. So it's a really complex field. I think what interests me about what connects these things is, and one of the reasons I use the sort of framing of populism, and by the way, I don't use that in a wholly derogatory way, is this sort of sense of kind of technological immediacy, this idea that you can insert technology into the equation and somehow short-circuit traditional institutions of politics and democracy, that somehow you can cut straight to the chase and actually affect change directly through the internet. And I think we're seeing that that's actually a hugely simplistic way of looking at the world.
Except for there are hackers, maybe not Anonymous per se, but maybe Anonymous, who do wield more power, at least momentarily.
Perhaps.
With the potential to wreck an entire financial institution, for example.
Yes, although the long-term consequences of that are more questionable, I think. And it's understandable completely in the sort of times that we live in that there's this huge wave of impatience with the kind of slow mode of traditional politics that leads people to look for and to want some kind of more immediate, hard-hitting way to make an impact on the world. And yet it may be that we need to recognize, in fact, that the kind of long, slow, boring work of institutional reform is actually still kind of essential in some ways to making sort of long-term changes. And a lot of these movements really are quite disdainful of those forms of politics and kind of dismiss them as being outmoded and irrelevant to our digital world. And I think that's a really sort of problematic and simplistic way of looking at things.
Thank you so much, Luke Good, for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Luke Good is a senior lecturer in media, film and television at the University of Auckland and the author of the book, Jürgen Habermas, Democracy in the Public Sphere. He has also published widely on social media, citizen journalism and hacktivism. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.